Pete Conrad and Richard Gordon were both staring down at the Earth through the forward windows on their Gemini capsule. Spread out below them was a wide bolt of ocean, broken in a couple of places by great green landmasses, awe-striking in their grandeur. But above all of that, there was a long tether, which reached out and away from the Gemini, toward their Agena stage, which rested below. It was an odd sight for a brain conditioned by decades of life on the Earth's surface. The Gemini seemed to float over the Agena, the thin band which linked them drifting limply between the two spacecraft. In any environment but a microgravity one, the Gemini would come crashing down on the Agena. But in orbit, there was no problem at all keeping the two spacecraft separated. Carefully nudging the controls, the astronauts prepared to attempt a maneuver that sounded foolhardy in the extreme to anyone not in the know. They were about to set their crew capsule and the Agena tied to it spinning. The last time a Gemini had begun to spin in orbit, it had nearly resulted in catastrophe and the loss of two astronauts. But that was precisely what Conrad and Gordon were about to do. Welcome to episode 34 of Frontier of Infinity, Flying High. In the last episode, we discussed Gemini 10, which saw Michael Collins and John Young set a new altitude record, while also getting in some more good practice with rendezvous and docking techniques, alongside an EVA that went far better than Gene Cernan's had on Gemini 9. Despite some problems, the mission was a success, and with just two flights remaining in the Gemini program, NASA became quite keen on testing the last of the skills they wanted to master before diving in on Project Apollo. In this episode, we're moving on to Gemini 11. March 21, 1966, saw the announcement of Gemini 11's crew. The mission would be commanded by Charles Pete Conrad, with Richard Gordon flying along as pilot. This would not be Pete Conrad's first spaceflight. He had flown as pilot with Gordon Cooper on Gemini 5, and if you'd like to hear more about how he became an astronaut, you can revisit our episode entitled 8 Days or Bust. Richard Gordon, however, would be making his first venture into space. Gordon was born in 1929 in Seattle, graduating high school in 1947. From there, he sought and achieved a bachelor's degree in chemistry from the University of Chicago. 2 years later, he became qualified as a naval aviator, specializing in all-weather flying. With this newfound expertise, he was assigned to an all-weather fighter squadron based out of Jacksonville, Florida. In 1957, he attended test pilot school and served Fighter Squadron 96 in a variety of capacities, as a test pilot, safety officer, assistant operations officer, and ground training officer. All of this experience saw him successfully navigate NASA's selection tests, and he was inducted into the Astronaut Corps. As the crew of Gemini 11, Conrad and Gordon would be expected to pull off a series of difficult maneuvers once in orbit. The first of these would be an attempt to carry out a rendezvous during their first orbit around the Earth. This would be faster than any rendezvous attempted previously, but would allow for the Apollo lunar orbit rendezvous plan to be validated, as the lunar lander ascending from the surface would need to rendezvous with the waiting command module within its first orbit. This was quite ambitious, and there were even some among NASA's ranks who doubted that it was feasible. After all, Gemini 10 had attempted a similar but less strenuous maneuver when they tried to pull off a rendezvous within 3 orbits. It had seen them burn through almost half of their fuel trying to get into position, which had seen the rest of the flight plan truncated to compensate. It was hoped, however, that the lessons gleaned from Gemini 10 would allow for a more economical use of fuel, and thus a successful first orbit rendezvous, which would leave plenty of fuel left over for the rest of the mission. The next major objective required a bit of elbow grease on the mission commander's part. Pete Conrad had become enamored with a short-lived dream which had emerged during his training for the Gemini 5 mission, wherein a Gemini would be sent to circle the moon and then return. The limitations of the Gemini spacecraft, as well as NASA's inexperience with such a long flight, saw the idea perish quite quickly, but it captivated Conrad. He understood full well why an orbit of the moon was out of the question. But maybe it would be possible to push the boundaries with the Gemini all the same without ever leaving Earth orbit. He was interested in flying as high as the Gemini was capable with the aid of the Agena target vessel. Gemini 10 had set a new altitude record, but Conrad was eager to smash it right away. Most in the NASA hierarchy were not thrilled with the idea, but some of NASA's scientists were. The meteorology department in particular was interested in getting pictures of clouds from as high up as possible, which would allow them to better calibrate transmission systems for weather photos in the future. However, there were also naysayers among the scientists who claimed that the radiation levels encountered from the lower Van Allen belts would contaminate any experiments conducted that high, rendering them effectively useless. Then there were also concerns about how much radiation exposure the astronauts would have to endure, and the potential health ramifications which might follow from such exposure. Conrad was not deterred, however, and he enlisted the aid of a fellow member of the Astronaut Corps, William Anders, who was trained as a nuclear engineer. The pair of them ventured to Washington, D.C., where they sought to turn the tide among the NASA leadership in favor of the high flight mission plan. They came armed not only with exuberant rhetoric, but also with a healthy dose of math. The flight of Gemini 10 had revealed that the estimated radiation levels at extreme altitudes were far higher than the reality. Gemini 10 had encountered only a tenth of the expected radiation as they flew at their highest altitude. This allowed Conrad and Anders to shoot down the complaints about radiation exposure posing too high of a health risk or concerns about it spoiling experiments. The case they laid out was convincing, and NASA management agreed that Gemini 11 would fly as high as their fuel supplies would allow. Officially, this was dubbed the High Apogee Excursion. The final objective of the mission was a good deal stranger than the first two. There was to be an experiment in generating artificial gravity on the Gemini spacecraft. Now, we've all seen many a science fiction movie wherein our intrepid heroes are able to walk around inside their spaceship as though they were standing on the surface of the Earth, regardless of whether or not they're accelerating or in what direction. Of course, rigging up harnesses and green screens in a film studio in such a manner to simulate microgravity for every scene where your characters are in space is expensive and difficult to pull off, so it's much easier to throw in a line or two about the gravity generator or the artificial gravity field and then film normally as though your characters were on the surface of a massive planet. This works just fine in the realm of science fiction. But unfortunately for us in the real world, we don't have gravity plating like in Star Trek, and thus have to turn to different solutions for simulating gravity in space. One of the best ways to do this is by generating spin gravity. Spin gravity is not actually gravity. It's a different force from the one that holds your feet on the ground every day, but it can create a similar effect. Spin gravity is created by spinning a spacecraft, and then using the centrifugal force generated by that spin to simulate the effect of gravity. To better understand this, imagine you're riding in a car. If you take a sharp turn, you'll feel yourself being thrown out toward the side of the car, away from the direction of the turn. This is because your body has inertia, or a reluctance to change its motion as per Isaac Newton's first law. Once the turn is completed, that effect disappears, as you are now traveling with the car in a new direction. However, if you were to drive the car in a circle, that centrifugal force would not dissipate, as your body would continuously resist the change in motion. If you were to drive that car fast enough, then the centrifugal force pushing you out toward the side of the car would be so great that you could stand on the wall of the car. Anyone who's ever ridden the Gravitron at your local county fair will be familiar with this concept. That ride spins fast enough that it pins you to the wall. Now, on Earth, that centrifugal force will be at odds with the force of gravity, and thus you'll be pulled in two directions at once. However, in freefall out in space, any spinning motion will be effectively isolated, and thus pseudo-gravity generated from spin will feel almost exactly like gravity generated by a planet or a moon. What's more, spin gravity allows us to control how strong the force of simulated gravity is. The faster we spin, the stronger the gravity, and vice versa. The crew of Gemini 11 would attempt to generate their own spin gravity by connecting the Gemini capsule to the Agena via a tether, before spinning them both around each other. This would be a difficult and potentially dangerous experiment to pull off. It needed to be carefully planned and executed. One of the first questions to be raised regarding this idea was what sort of tether would be used. It needed to be lightweight, and yet strong enough to hold the two spacecraft together. Nylon was posited as a possible material, but it ultimately lost out to Dacron, a type of polyester fiber. It would be spun into a 98-foot, about 30-meter-long line. It would need to be affixed between the spacecraft via an EVA. The next problem was how the two spacecraft could be decoupled in the event of an emergency. The last time a Gemini capsule and a Agena target had started spinning in space, it nearly killed Dave Scott and Neil Armstrong. The solution was to rig up an explosive release mechanism on the Agena, which could be blown at a moment's notice to separate the two craft. In case the explosive failed, the line would be engineered with an intentional failure point, which would break under a specified load in the event that the two spacecraft began to spin out of control. The EVA was another point of potential catastrophe. Even though Michael Collins' EVA on Gemini 10 had gone well, the memory of Gene Cernan's ordeal on Gemini 9 was still fresh. Cernan was called in to test new EVA training methods, and more handholds were added to the outside of the spacecraft to better facilitate movement. Little cavities into which the astronauts could plant their feet were also added, dubbed golden slippers by the astronaut corps. The supply tether was also shortened to make it more manageable, but the trade-off was that the astronaut would not be able to stray as far from the capsule. A number of issues saw the launch postponed from its original September 9th launch date, but on the 12th of that month, the Atlas carrying Gemini 11's Agena shot skyward. It reached orbit and relayed its position to the ground, allowing lightning-quick calculations to be carried out so as to determine the launch window which would allow the first orbit rendezvous to happen. That window was just 2 seconds long, by far the shortest of the program thus far. Gemini Titan 11 rumbled up after the Agena within the acceptable window and enjoyed a perfect insertion into orbit. The mission was underway. As soon as they were in orbit, Conrad and Gordon set to work on the rendezvous. They pulled off an insertion velocity adjust routine, or IVAR maneuver, which brought their orbital path in line with the Agena's. Just as the Gemini strayed beyond range with the ground stations, Conrad and Gordon set to making a few additional adjustments to their flight path. They raised up the nose and adjusted their speed, scanning for the Agena with their radar. When it pinged on the screen, it registered as 58 miles, or about 93 kilometers distant. As the capsule entered back into communications range with the ground stations, the crew checked their calculations against those made on the ground, finding them to be nearly identical. All was going well, and the Gemini was closing in on the Agena. Just shy of an hour and a half after reaching orbit, Conrad's voice rang out over the radio, "We are docked." The first major mission objective had been completed. On the flight of Gemini 10, the crew were supposed to practice casting off from the Agena target and redocking, but the fuel shortage they experienced had removed this from the plan. With plenty of fuel in reserve, Conrad and Gordon got to actually do it, each taking turns decoupling and recoupling with the Agena in both darkness and sunlight. Conrad was pleased to report that the operation was actually easier in space than it was in training on the ground. Once the docking practice was finished, it was time to test out the Agena engine for the high apogee excursion. Their orbital inclination was altered relative to the equator, and then they settled in for their first rest period. When they next set to work, they would hook up the tether for the risky gravity experiment, and then prepare for the high apogee excursion. 8 hours later, Conrad and Gordon returned to wakefulness and got to work. They had 4 hours in which to prepare for the EVA, but they had trained so well on Earth that they needed only a fraction of that time to get ready. Their efficiency was rewarded with roughly an hour of idle time, during which Gordon had to remain in his EVA suit. But after sitting for a time, the astronauts launched in on a test of the suit's life support system. This quickly caused a problem, as the suit's systems pumped oxygen into the cabin and raised the internal pressure enough to activate the relief valve that released some of that gas out into space. A measure of oxygen was thus wasted, but Conrad instructed Gordon to switch back to the capsule's oxygen supply, and the wastage was stopped. After spending almost exactly 1 day in space, 24 hours and 2 minutes, Gordon was ready to leave the capsule. When he popped the hatch, he began to float out, but Conrad grabbed his foot and stabilized him well enough to get a grip on the handholds outside the capsule. He plucked a radiological experiment off of the capsule's skin and passed it down to Conrad before he climbed out completely and retrieved the tether for the gravity experiment. Moving toward the nose of the craft, he tried to wedge his foot in between the capsule and the docking adapter, just as he had practiced many times successfully on Earth, but he found that it was much more difficult than it had been in the simulations. He couldn't quite hold himself in place well enough to work with both hands, and thus had to use one hand to hold himself in place and work the tether with just his single remaining hand. It took him 6 minutes to get the tether properly attached, a duration which saw Gordon begin to fatigue. Just as had happened with Cernan on Gemini 9, he began to breathe heavily, and had to blink through rivers of sweat which came streaming off of his brow. He left the mirror in place outside the capsule, which Conrad would use to keep an eye on him when he was working at the aft of the spacecraft, and when Conrad saw how tired Gordon had become after just a short time in space, he canceled the rest of the EVA. Gordon was supposed to spend over an hour and a half in space, but he had lasted barely 37 minutes. It wasn't a promising sign that humans could effectively work in space, but Gene Cernan and Michael Collins would surely understand. Everything was more difficult in outer space. Even so, the tether for the gravity experiment was hooked up. It could still move forward as planned. Gordon climbed back inside without difficulty, and then eagerly took part in another rest session. Both astronauts skipped breakfast when they awoke, and instead set straight to work cleaning up the cabin for the long burn to high apogee. With their spacesuits on and visors closed, they waited for the word to come from the ground that they were clear to light the Agena's engine and gain altitude. Finally, word came from the Canary Island station. Go for burn. Conrad issued the command to light the engine, and the Agena touched off. As both astronauts were sitting facing the direction of thrust, the sudden acceleration threw them forward into their seatbelts as the Agena muscled the combined spacecraft further up the Earth's gravity well. The burn lasted for only 25 seconds, but it was enough. The spacecraft accrued an extra 683 miles per hour, or 1,099 kilometers per hour, and reached an altitude of 852 miles. About 1,371 kilometers. They were flying higher than anyone had ever done before, and it wasn't likely that record was going to be broken anytime soon. What was more, the radiation levels were manageable, lower than even those encountered by Gemini 10, and for two full orbits, Gemini 11 raced around the Earth at ridiculous altitude. When these two orbits were finished, another burn slowed them down and brought them back within 189 miles, or 304 kilometers, of the surface. Conrad had gotten to push the envelope just like he'd wanted to. They both ate a meal after their high-flying excursion, and then prepared for a much simpler EVA than the one attempted earlier. This one was a stand-up EVA, or one which did not require Gordon to actually leave the capsule. Instead, he would just pop the hatch and stand up on his seat, poking his head and shoulders up through it with most of his body still inside. A short tether would keep him connected to the capsule so that he could use both of his hands to mount cameras on the outside of the spacecraft, which would snap photos of the air glow surrounding the Earth. Unfortunately, there were some problems with the cameras, and the experiment was only partially successful, but this EVA proved much easier and exerted very little strain on Gordon. He managed to keep his head outside the spacecraft for more than 2 hours before he pulled back inside and shut the hatch behind himself. With a much nicer EVA under their belt, Conrad and Gordon were finally ready to make use of the tether which had been attached to the Gemini and the Agena during the first spacewalk. There were two ideas for how to keep the Gemini and the Agena at opposite ends of the tether and equidistant from each other. The first plan was to orient the Agena so that it pointed down at the Earth, and the Gemini over the top of it, its aft section pointed out into space. The two spacecraft would be decoupled, and then the Gemini would slowly back away until the tether was pulled taut between them. In this formation, the two vessels should not have moved relative to one another. The second was to decouple the two spacecraft and then slowly rotate them around each other at a rate of just 1 degree per second, much slower than Armstrong and Scott's thrill ride on Gemini 8. The centrifugal force would keep them apart, just like we discussed earlier in the episode. When the first plan was attempted, the tether got stuck on two separate occasions, prompting that idea to be abandoned in lieu of the second one. Conrad did manage to pull off this maneuver, but the tether began to behave oddly when the spacecraft first started to rotate. It took on the shape of an arc and began to rotate counterclockwise while still under tension. Conrad manipulated the controls and managed to straighten it out, but he and ground control were both at a loss for exactly how he had managed it. Still, it was done, and the two vehicles did eventually stabilize. They spun around each other successfully, generating a very slight pseudo-gravitational force, demonstrating at the very least that such a thing could be done. The two spacecraft whirled around each other for roughly 3 hours, and once decoupled, the astronauts undertook some extra rendezvous practice before they enjoyed an easy re-entry and splashed down into the ocean to be picked up by the helicopter carrier USS Guam. Gemini 11 achieved all of its primary objectives, and had only faltered on a few of the secondary ones, but it had failed to solve the spacewalk enigma. After 5 spacewalks, it was still difficult, dangerous, and unpleasant for everyone involved. Was it possible that NASA's goal of proving that humans could work in space wasn't really feasible? If that were the case, it would greatly limit the possibilities of human activity beyond the atmosphere, and perhaps even imperil the Apollo program. But NASA were not pleased to throw in the towel. There was one more Gemini flight left, and they would make full use of it to master the EVA problem before Project Apollo began to fly. Next time, we'll fly along as NASA attempts to pull off the perfect spacewalk with the grand finale of the Gemini program, Gemini 12. As always, thanks to all of you for listening. If you like this show and you want to help me out, please follow the podcast, share it with your friends and family, and leave it a rating if you feel so inclined. It really does help. Our theme music is Crossing the Universe by Esther Garcia. You can listen to the full track and more of her music on Spotify. Until next time, I'm Tom. This is Frontier of Infinity. I'll see you among the stars.